Hello and welcome to Truth News Radio Australia. It is Friday the 6th of November 2009, and tonight I bring you a special feature. We're going to devote the entire show tonight to an interview with Richard Gage. Richard Gage is a San Francisco Bay Area architect, AIA, member of the American Institute of Architects, and founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. Richard is coming to Sydney next week for the Hard Evidence Conference, which we've been talking about quite a bit on this show, so if you're a regular listener, you'll know all about it. But if you haven't heard about it, make sure you go to www.thehardevidence.com, and that will give you all the information about the conference. Richard, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for joining us at short notice.
Oh, you're very welcome, Herward. It's great to be here with you.
Look, it is really, really important for us to be able to speak to you on this show. We've been going for about a year and a half now. We cover a lot of subjects. We're not totally focused on the 9/11 questions. We cover a lot of issues of information that is not getting out in terms of the mainstream media. But 9/11 is always a major, major theme on this show. And we had the pleasure of interviewing another architectural expert, Dr. David Leifer from Sydney University, on the show. And we've also spoken to Dr. Frank Legg, and they've really been excellent, really, really important contributors. But Richard, you really are the founder of the Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, and what you've done is incredibly important. You know, to me personally, to everyone listening to this show, what you've done is just so important, because I mean, I've been in the position a few years ago before there was a 911truth.org. You know, I've been in the position of being on forums debating with people about these questions, and they've said, you know, the people who are the so-called debunkers, the ones that basically want to, you know, correct us on all our faults, had said, oh, there are no architects and engineers, you know, and you're not qualified. And quite often we have this response from members of the general public when we're doing street actions, when we're talking to people, you know, they say, well, you're not qualified. And, you know, there is that sense, well, actually, I'm not. I mean, I've got a good general education, but I certainly couldn't call myself in any way qualified to be an expert in the subjects of engineering and architecture and what would make a building collapse and what isn't. But I feel very confident of the knowledge that I've developed. But having someone with the knowledge that you have, based on years of experience and professional experience, brings this to a whole other level. So, you know, thanks for what you've done. It's just so important. I can't overstress it. And your visit to Australia hopefully will bring a change in the way this is perceived. And I was wondering if you could maybe just elaborate your kind of feeling at the moment as to how the whole cause that you're working for is developing. I notice on the website at the moment, on the Architects and Engineers website, we've now got 955 architectural and engineering professionals who've signed the petition, and that's been growing constantly. So it looks positive. What's the view from your end?
Well, let me first give your listeners an idea of where I've come from. I've been an architect for well over 20 years, and I've worked on many different types of buildings, residential, commercial, institutional, and large steel-framed fireproofed buildings. Most recently, a $400 million project I co-managed in Nevada with over 1,200 tons of fireproof steel framing. That was a mid-rise office space and commercial space and parking structure. that's and about 3.5 years ago, though, I was on my way to a construction site observation, and I heard David Ray Griffin on the radio. First time I've ever heard any other explanation as to how these buildings came down, other than what we heard right away from the experts on the mainstream media. And David Ray Griffin was explaining a whole set of evidence that I had not heard or considered at all. And I'm going, well, why didn't I hear about this if it's true, you know? So I checked it out, and it seemed to have been true. And not only that, there's all of this other evidence that he didn't get a chance to talk about on the radio that night. So I started assembling all of this and the work of Dr. Stephen Jones, a physicist from Brigham Young University, and showed this information after I had been talking to people about it at the office I worked for. They all thought I was nuts, but I put together the presentation. I showed them a one-hour slide show, and had to buy them pizza to get them to come and watch it.
Really?
And all of them were convinced, every one of them. We got 14 petition signers, our first 14 that day. And it's been like that ever since. 85 to 90% of architects and engineers that look at this information are blown away by what they see. They're aghast that they have not been shown all of this evidence that we're going to be going through today and in Sydney.
Yes.
On the dates that you mentioned for the hard evidence conference. It's just amazing how successful this missing evidence, once we show it to people, is in changing people's perceptions and, in fact, their worldviews, because this is a very dark implication. This evidence has a very dark implication for America, and that's why people are completely incredulous when you first bring it up to them. But when you get them in front of it, they are moved.
And it's really interesting and instructive that you're saying that even the first time you presented this to a group of people who were just randomly the people you were working with, you know, that's a really good representative sample of, you know, the professional, you know, environment. And these people responded. And so what I get from that is that once this information is presented to people who have the knowledge, it really can't be it can't be argued against. Despite the multiple, you know, government reports from NIST and FEMA, and the few statements that we've had from people who, you know, claim that the buildings came down as a result of fire or, you know, damaged fireproofing or whatever. What you're saying is your experience is that anyone with the actual knowledge of the way buildings work can see it straight away, and there's not much debate.
Well, and not just people who are architects and engineers, but everybody else sees it too. This is very intuitive, easily recognizable evidence. For instance, we start off talking about World Trade Center 7. Now, this is a 47-story skyscraper that was not hit by an airplane on 9/11, and yet it collapses in the afternoon of 9/11 after the Twin Towers. We start with it because, first of all, almost nobody is familiar with its collapse. Most architects and engineers that I talk to are completely unaware of the third worst structural failure in modern history, because we simply have not seen it on mainstream media, with extremely few exceptions. So they're not prejudiced. First of all, everybody knows everything there is to know about the Twin Towers, which is not true,
right.
But that's what they think. So we start them with Building 7 because its collapse it begins suddenly and symmetrically and smoothly, and all of a sudden, the penthouse goes down first in the east part, and then the center part, and then the whole building comes down in just 6.5 seconds. Now, this is free fall acceleration, and this is acknowledged by NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, tasked with explaining this collapse to us. They acknowledge and admit that it came down at free fall for 8 stories of its fall. Now, the implication of that is extraordinary. They don't acknowledge the implication. The implication is that you have to remove the core columns, at least, in order, on any given floor, for 8 floors at least, synchronistically timed and within a tenth of a second of each other or so, so that this building can come straight down, symmetrical and a free fall. A building can't convert all of its gravitational energy, its potential energy, into kinetic energy, which is motion, and do any other work. It can't crush 40,000 tons of structural steel that was designed to keep this building from collapsing, and in fact was 3 to 5 times stronger than it needed to be in order to do that. That's how structural engineers work. They make these buildings that much stronger than they need to be. So this is, everybody has knows, not just engineers, but even 7th and 8th graders that we've shown this information to. They know that a building can't fall at free fall speed without its columns being cut. This is a key feature of classic controlled demolition, and it had to have been that. We've all seen that in the old hotels, for instance, in Las Vegas when they come down. We've seen this so many times. So once we show this to architects, engineers, and others, they immediately recognize what it is, even before we get to the evidence, the chemical evidence, and other evidence of controlled demolition left in the pile at the bottom.
Look, you know, for those of us who've been over this ground, you know, we know it, we understand it. I've been researching this now for 5 years. I mean, but what I'm curious about is, have you ever had a chance to sit down with one of these people from NIST, like Dr. Sundar, Shyam Sundar, who led the investigation? Because, I mean, it seems like when any reasonable people sit down and look at this, they end up agreeing, because you really can't say something totally preposterous. Like, you can't sort of propose that Newton's laws were suspended, and you have to say that in order to explain what happened. Whereas when official reports are released that have, you know, lots of verbiage in them, that basically don't say anything concrete, it's quite easy for these people to sort of avoid engaging with this key question. Have you ever had a chance to actually just sit down in a relaxed way and talk to any of these decision makers from NIST?
No, they won't talk to us. We have tried and tried. They're unwilling to do that. We've tried to talk to the American Institute of Architects national president and the board, of which I'm a member of the AIA. They simply will, even though we have over 50 members of AIA members,
right,
among our numerous architects, including 4 FAIA members, fellows. These are lifetime distinguished architects. They won't talk to us. So, in fact, we've asked for anybody with a degree, technical background, to debate us so that we can get this information out. And we're getting just a couple of bites right now. In fact, we may have a debate with a faculty from the research engineers from the New Mexico Tech Institute. So that will be very interesting. We hope that happens.
Absolutely.
Yeah, they don't want to talk about this because there's no defense against the evidence that we find, for instance, at the bottom of the World Trade Center 7.
Right.
What is it? Several tons, for instance, of molten metal found by the first responders and iron workers and structural engineers.
Yeah.
Flowing like lava, these firemen say. We have photographs of it being picked up by the buckets with the dripping molten metal, the ends of the beams dripping with molten metal. Where does all of this come from? This building collapsed, according to NIST, due to normal office fires with a new phenomena called thermal expansion, because they say that the beams, long-span beams, expanded, pushing a girder off of its seat, causing successive floor failures internally cascading inside the building and then the overall building coming down. All this, of course, happens in just 6.5. Well, all of this happens inside the building in the first 10 or 15 seconds.
Right.
If that were true, it would mean that the building had to have been losing 400 structural steel connections per second. This is extraordinary. I mean, fires just don't do this, but controlled demolitions are designed to do just that. And so where did all this molten metal come from? The fires are only 1,600 degrees at their hottest.
Yeah.
This is Fahrenheit, and we have to convert this to centigrade. So what's that? Roughly 700.
Yeah, around about 700, centigrade. Yeah.
But the steel doesn't even begin to melt until twice that temperature. So where did the temperature, the heat energy, come from to melt all that steel that rapidly? It turns out that some of the steel was analyzed by Dr. Stephen Jones, a physicist formerly from Brigham Young University here in the U.S., and he finds that the previously molten metal has in it the chemical evidence of thermite, a high-tech, it's an incendiary,
yeah,
used by the military and others to cut through steel like a hot knife through butter. Thermite is not used in normal controlled demolitions, but it's an interesting choice because it doesn't have the large bang of C4 or RDX, high-energy explosives. It doesn't have the bright flash either of those explosives which are normally used in controlled demolitions. So if you were trying to do a deceptive controlled demolition, then you would do well, perhaps, to make this choice, although you would have all of this molten metal, because molten iron, as it turns out, because that is the byproduct of thermite, molten iron at 4,500 degrees spewing out. If you had several thousand charges in the building, you would have several tons of molten iron, which is exactly what the first responders saw. In fact, FEMA documents in their Appendix C, and they were tasked with the first report prior to NIST in May of 2002. Their Appendix C documents a couple of beams that were saved from the World Trade Center 7, and they are melted beyond recognition like Swiss cheese. This is documentation of the melting, and they call it intergranular melting, where molten iron has invaded the grain boundaries of the steel. Rapid oxidation, sulfidation. Remember, sulfur added to thermite becomes thermate, lowers the melting point of steel.
Right.
So this is damning evidence. And what does NIST do with this evidence from Appendix C? They throw it out. And it's not a part of the official story at all in the NIST report. This is really the destruction of evidence, speaking of which, FEMA came out in May of 2002 with this report citing that their best hypothesis as to how this building came down, which is fire,
yeah,
and then random damage and complete collapse, has only a low probability of occurrence.
Yeah,
they can't even have no faith in their best hypothesis. They say further research, investigation, and analysis are necessary in order to resolve this issue. But unfortunately, for those hoping to resolve the issue, we find that the steel had been ordered and shipped to China for recycling even prior to the report coming out saying, hey, let's look at this deal and see what happened to this building.
It's and now the question of the steel being shipped out, this was in violation of the codes, which are actually criminal codes, as I understand it, for investigation of fires. So there's actually a breach of procedure there, isn't there, right at the beginning?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're supposed to save the steel. This is what's done in collapses, catastrophic collapses. Everything is categorized, labeled, laid out, understood. It was not done. In fact, FEMA is the one, I understand, that ordered the steel to be shipped away. Interestingly enough, we also have Kevin McCadden, a local first responder, Air Force medic. He is hearing a countdown, 3, 2, 1, from a
right.
radio held by a Red Cross worker a few blocks away from Building 7. And then there's all these explosions. He describes the ground rumbling like you needed to grab onto something.
Right.
He says he knew these were explosions, and many others heard these explosions and document them. Whistleblower Kevin Bartmer of the New York Police Department, Barry Jennings, worker on the 23rd floor of Mayor Giuliani's Office of Emergency Management. So there's this foreknowledge, all of this foreknowledge. The BBC announces the collapse of this building 20 minutes before it even happened. Now, keep in mind, fires have never brought down steel frame high-rises, ever, even though there's been much larger, longer-lasting, and hotter fires in dozens and dozens of examples of high-rise fires. But here they're announcing the collapse before it happened. In fact, CNN catches these mysterious construction workers and police officer talking about this. We have this in our DVD, which is available at our website,
right.
which is ae911truth.org. That stands for Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, ae911truth.org. And in this DVD, people will hear the construction workers saying, did you hear that? Keep your eye on that building. It's coming down. The building's about to blow up. Flame and debris coming down. We're moving it back. It's unbelievable.
Yes, I've seen that video, and it's very clear that there's some foreknowledge there, and it's certainly kind of been some random freak event if they knew it was going to happen. Those two pieces of data don't match up. Now, look, can we just clarify one thing for some of our listeners? Because, like, a lot of people, when they come to this subject, when you start pointing out these glaring inconsistencies between the official explanation and the evidence that's subsequently come out, they immediately fire back the question, well, so who did it? You know, who did it? And as far as I understand, like, what your website and your group, you're not claiming to know who did it. You're looking at the scientific structural evidence, and you're saying that we need a new investigation to find out who did it. Would that be a fair sort of... I'm trying to sort of deal with the questions or the allegations of, you know, conspiracy theorizing, which always sort of taint this movement. But in your case, you've got a very clear stand on this. Would you like to expand on that at all?
Sure. We're architects and engineers. Our expertise is looking at buildings and engineering processes, and we don't know who did it. We don't research those types of issues. We look at the forensic evidence. Obviously, somebody did it.
Yeah.
We have a building that's occupied by the CIA, the IRS, the Department of Defense, New York Mayor Giuliani's Office of Emergency Management. This is an extremely secure building. It is extremely unlikely that Al-Qaeda had access to this building. So we assume, obviously, that it was some sort of an inside job. Beyond that, what we're calling for is a real investigation into the evidence, as well as, you know, who may have benefited, who had the means, the motive, the opportunity. These are typical criminal targets that are looked for in a real investigation, where we have subpoena power, where we provide immunity to witnesses to get information. So this is an investigation with teeth that is the subject of a petition that the over 950 architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth have signed. But there is some interesting research done by others, including David Ray Griffin, who has written now 8 books on this subject. And we encourage people to get his book. It's available on our website, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited.
Right.
As well as his latest book on World Trade Center 7, and which just rips apart the NIST report, which is the official final report that came out in November of 2009.
Yeah.
8, excuse me. So that was a year ago, and he's done a great job. We're going to make him an honorary architect.
Great, yeah. I mean, it must be hard plowing through such a. It's quite a dense volume, isn't it? I mean, it's not light reading.
Yeah. It's very technical.
Yeah.
But it's a very, very good resource. He is already. Documented much of the evidence found in the World Trade Center Twin Towers, which we want to touch on here too as well, because once you realize that World Trade Center 7 was a controlled demolition, and most everybody does, as I mentioned, looking at the DVD or one of our live presentations, which we always do a show of hands,
yes,
85 to 90% of the architects and engineers are moved from believing in the official story to agreeing with the evidence for controlled demolition. Then when they get to the Twin Towers, their minds are open. Because we start by saying, well, look, what fire and jet fuel can and can't do to steel is really irrelevant. We're talking about the evidence for explosive controlled demolition after the beginning, or at the beginning of the destruction of this building, which is 56 minutes after the South Tower is hit by the plane, and an hour and a half after the North Tower. And what do we see? We see immediately in the case of the North Tower, this 15-story section above the point of jet plane impacts begin to decrease in volume. It telescopes in on itself. It's destroying itself, in other words, and hurling its mass laterally. And in 4 seconds, it's gone. Well, wait a minute. That was supposed to be the section of building that drove the rest of the building down to the ground in, by the way, just 10 to 12 seconds. So if it's gone, what drove the rest of the building down? Well, what we see after 4 seconds, there's no videos or photos that show any kind of a pile driver driving the rest of the building down. It's tearing itself apart, and it's doing that at 2/3 of free fall acceleration. That means it's falling, it's not falling, it's destroying itself at that rapid pace with belts of explosions as described by over 100 first responders on tape. that we didn't even know about until August of 2005, by the way. They talk about flashes of light at the onset of this destruction, belts of explosions wrapping all the way around the building. Well, we document this and show it in our DVD. And it's hurling 4-ton, 20-ton perimeter wall units 600 feet laterally in order for them to travel that far. And when they hit the ground, they have to be exiting instantly at 50 to 70 miles per hour out of the sides of the Twin Towers. Some force is responsible for that, and it is the incredible force of explosives, which are also pulverizing 90,000 tons of concrete in midair all the way down the building, developing into this giant mushroom cloud that has become iconic image with 9/11.
Look, Richard, we're just going to take a short break, just for a promotional break. And look, in the second half, I want to get more into more detail about the Twin Towers, and also want to get into the research that you and Stephen Jones and others have done into the nanothermite. So we'll just we'll take a short break now, and we'll be right back. Listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Okay, we are back and you're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, and tonight I am talking to Richard Gage, founder of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. That's ae911.org. Really excellent website, which I commend to you to have a look at and follow.
That is That's ae911truth.
Oh, sorry.
.org.
So sorry. Yeah, ae911truth.org. Correct. Yes, really excellent website and a really important contribution to truth and justice. Richard, we were just in the last section there, we were getting into the World Trade Center Twin Towers, which for some people, you know, it's obviously more complex to understand it. It doesn't look like a conventional demolition, but you were pointing out there that the amount of energy involved with lateral ejections at huge speeds and the pulverization basically requires an additional energy source. There's just no way it can happen from simple gravitational effects. And I mean, you know, from my kind of layman's perspective, I can explain that quite clearly. I mean, you know, you've got gravitational potential energy, and that gets translated into the kinetic energy of motion as an object falls. But of course, when that potential energy is translated into kinetic energy, then if the object is falling without resistance, then there will be the free fall acceleration that we see, like when an object is dropped through the air. But of course, if that object encounters something in its way, it will have to slow down. Unless there's some extra source of energy, there's simply no way that you can have free fall and pulverization at the same time, because there is more energy required. Of course, it happened. We saw it. It happened. So something must have supplied the energy. Now, you've championed the research of Stephen Jones and the discovery of the microspheres in the dust, and the current theory that you've put forward, which I've heard you talking about on a few different shows, is that this is actually a high-tech form of thermite called nanothermite, and that it's a highly refined material. It's not even anything like what would be sold as thermite in a hardware store or anything that you could buy. It's a nanothermite. It's a unique sort of bonding of molecules that makes it actually quite explosive and much more reactive than it normally is. And you've actually said that this could potentially be painted or sprayed on to building beams. And I think this is just a really interesting point, because people do need to understand how it's possible that these buildings could have been rigged to blow up. And they think about conventional explosives, and people who've done conventional demolitions have said, well, you've got to do all this wiring and you've got to set up all this complicated stuff, and there's just no way you could do it without anyone knowing about it. Well, the question is, we don't know exactly how they did it, but if you're proposing this method that's presumably can be done a lot quicker and with a lot lighter footprint than sort of conventional explosive demolition.
Well, let's start by realizing that in a gravitational collapse, we would expect 110 floors to be stacked up in a mess, certainly, but stacked up somehow at the bottom of each of these twin towers. And it's extremely important to know that the photos and the videos after the collapse show no floors stacked up at all at the bottom of either of these towers. There's only a two-story pile of debris, and that pile is columns and beams, aluminum cladding. And so there's no pancakes found at the bottom of a pancaking collapse. That's extremely disturbing for architects to realize. Also, on the way down, we have explosives going off 20, 40, and even 60 stories down below this canopy of destruction, if you will. These are told by us to be puffs of air produced by this pile driver pushing air down. Well, there is no pile driver, first of all. It's been destroyed, as we mentioned, in the first 4 seconds. And these occur 60 stories down. Well, and they're pulverized building materials, and they're shooting out of the building at 160 to 200 feet per second. These are propelled only by explosives. So this is very important information. Now, in addition, we find at the base of both of these twin towers, just like we did with Building 7, several pools, several tons of flowing molten iron. As it turns out, it's iron. It's actually pouring also out of the side of the South Tower at floor 78, 10 minutes prior to the collapse. Well, this molten iron, we've already discussed, contains the chemical evidence of thermite, which is iron and aluminum and sulfur. There's manganese in it as well. This is the chemical signature of thermite. But not only that, Dr. Jones starts looking at the dust, and this really pulverized concrete to a fine talcum powder. There's hardly any macroscopic chunks of concrete found at the base of the Twin Towers. It's all been powderized and sent over all of Lower Manhattan in 4 to 12-inch thick blankets. Well, in this dust, he puts a magnet to it, does some interesting analysis, looking, you know, for possible explosives. He finds that there's angular pieces of like metal filings, but there's also billions of these spheres, which are about the size of the human hair, most of them, and some in diameter, and some are larger. Well, how did they get formed? Well, if you had thousands of cutter charges laced throughout the columns and beams in the building, and they were detonated under explosive conditions. The byproduct of thermite being liquid molten iron would disperse itself, atomize, like coming out of a spray bottle, and it would form itself into spheres. That's what liquid does when it's atomized because of the surface tension. And this would fall and cool and fall with all of the dust throughout the lower Manhattan. So that's the only rational explanation, in fact, for these spheres, which are found only right 10 minutes away on the Brooklyn Bridge, collected on top of the skyscraper, two, three blocks away from the Twin Towers and from the apartment building across the street from the South Tower, all of these samples.
And we have a good chain of custody for these samples, don't we? Like it's quite certain that we actually have the people who found them. They've spoken up. I've seen all that.
Well, there's a whole lot of dust. There's an infinite supply of dust. Right. It's available. And in fact, R.J. Lee finds these spheres in their dust. They cite that they're in fact mostly iron. Also, Dr. Jones does chemical analysis on them, finds that they're iron. There's also aluminum and other components that tie it directly to the byproduct of thermite. This is very clear. It's found also by USGS doing toxicological studies of the area. Well, Dr. Jones gets real curious and he says, "Well, would there be any evidence of unignited thermite? And what would be the original recipe of this?" He can reverse engineer, in other words, and determine that we would have powdered iron oxide, powdered aluminum. And so he starts looking for this in the dust with his magnet because iron is attracted to a magnet. So he finds it. All of these chips, he missed them the first time. This is only about a year ago. And they come up to the magnet. And the biggest chip he found was a 16th of an inch long. And on one side it's gray and on the other side it's red. So what is the red side is composed of these extremely small particles of iron oxide and aluminum powders that are 1,000 times smaller than the human hair. These are nanoscale particles. And the iron oxide is rhomboidal in shape, about 40 nanometers across, and the aluminum platelets are about 300-400 nanometers long, 40 nanometers thick, hexagonal crystalline-type aluminum platelets. This is like way smaller than you can ever see with the human eye, and they're mixed in the perfect 1/4 to 3/4 ratio, iron oxide to aluminum, to make thermite. And these materials are set in a porous matrix of silica, carbon. It is which can assist in the explosive result of this nanothermite, because when these particles get this small, according to Lawrence Livermore Lab, who did research on this over 10 years ago, these particles become... The surface area is huge because the particle size is so small, and therefore the chemical reaction is almost instantaneous, and it is extraordinarily explosive. So now you have an incendiary that actually becomes explosive with its result, but without the large bang of like C4 or RDX, and without the bright flash associated with normal controlled demolitions.
Right.
So again, nanothermite becomes quite an interesting choice for those trying to provide a deceptive controlled demolition.
And nanothermite, it's a recognized substance. There's a Wikipedia article on it that I've looked at. It's known. It exists. It's not widely known to the general public, but... I believe that NIST, the actual investigative body who wrote the report, knows something about it.
Well, as a matter of fact, NIST was instrumental in developing nanothermite. And not only that, the people that were brought in to lead the NIST investigation turned out to be experts in nanothermite, and they could easily have found it in the dust if they wanted to, but they refused to look for any evidence of explosives, despite the hundreds of witnesses there are that heard explosions. There, none of them are a part of the official story at all today. And we document this on our DVD quite carefully. In fact, the individuals, this is documented, this top 10 connections between NIST and nanothermite by Kevin Ryan.
Excellent article, yeah.
And yes, it's in the Journal of 911studies.com.
Another great site, another great site.
So this is direct evidence of explosive destruction in both World Trade Center 7 and the Twin Towers. And guess what? Fire and jet fuel can't account for any of these features, let alone all 10 of them that we cite. And so we have pulled the rug out from underneath the official story of these buildings being collapsed by jet fuel fires and weakening of structural steel. Whether that happened or not is irrelevant. What we have is the direct chemical and physical evidence for explosive controlled demolition of all three high-rises on 9/11. And this is what prompts the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth to call for a real investigation. Our country is in deep trouble because, again, with the Twin Towers, these are extremely highly secure buildings. Al-Qaeda probably did not have access to the buildings. They surely did not have access to this very, very high-tech substance, which is made only in the most sophisticated Defense Department contracting laboratories,
right,
not in a cave in Afghanistan.
Right, right. Are you aware of any applications of nanothermite that have actually been used that are acknowledged? Like, has it actually...
There's just testing and research that's been done and documented in Lawrence Livermore Lab and Los Alamos Lab.
Right, so it's still technically a research thing. But as we know, with a lot of military technologies, I go into use way before they come anywhere near the general public. So as to whether it had already been developed into a kind of a weaponized, you know, an actual practical form of explosive, that's why we need an investigation to find out, I guess. That's one of the things that has to be explored. And I guess, you know, investigating the research into nanothermite would be one of the main lines of inquiry, I'd imagine, that that you'd want to explore in a you know, an investigation with subpoena power, because you'd want to get some of these nanothermite people up on the stand, I'd imagine.
Yeah, you bet. We sure would.
Yeah, yeah. I'm sure they'd have some interesting stories to tell. Now, just a couple of questions about, you know, the practicalities of this, because some sort of debunkers have said, well, you know, planes in the building, right? So plane comes in, smashes everything. How can you execute a controlled demolition when you've had this total random act of chaos, you know, attack the central core of the building? Wouldn't that sort of either make everything go off at the wrong time or fail to go off? And that's one reason for sort of, you know, saying, well, you know, for people to argue that, well, it can't have been a controlled demolition. Can you just maybe engage with that? Because, I mean, the fact of the planes going in is what sticks in people's minds, and it's so shocking that most people, including me, you know, for quite a few years, I just accepted that the planes brought the building down because I'd never seen a plane fly into a building like that, and it was so horrific that you just sort of think, well, if that's possible, anything could happen, including the building coming down. You know, it's just this question of what the planes were able to do. Is, I believe, you know, a really important one.
No, it's irrelevant what the planes, what damage the planes did to the building, because we're talking about the evidence that happened after that,
right,
for explosive controlled demolition. And same with the fire. The fire cannot create these 10 key characteristics that we've been discussing here today, and along with the nanothermite and so forth. This is very, very high-tech material.
So the point here is that the planes, with, you know, the jet fuel, the explosion, whatever damage was done, that obviously the demolition process was able to be carried out despite the planes having struck the building.
Okay. Well, let's speculate about,
sure,
that. We don't exactly know how the nanothermite might work, but Jim Hoffman and the scientists have suggested that this is extremely high-tech stuff that is engineered to be detonated under very, very narrow range of circumstances, electrical or temperature. Certainly the plane damaged portions of the pre-placed explosives. That can't be argued. But the rest of them were not damaged and were easily set offable, if you will, remotely. You don't have to run miles of det cord,
right,
for instance, like you used to. These are wireless detonation with micro devices that are available for this purpose. I don't know how often and how this material was used, but you raised the point before that perhaps this material was sprayed on.
Right.
Indeed, it's a sol gel. It's a bilayered product. It probably was sprayed on. It appears to be that way. And we don't know, you know, maybe it was sprayed on the floors, under the floors, on the ceiling tiles. It appears that the columns didn't have this application. They appear to have been at the weld points. Every 37.5 feet is a welded point of the columns running vertically through the building. They appear to have sustained a side concussive blast, breaking the welds, because many of these columns have deformed long edges. These are box beams.
Right.
In some cases, 36 inches by 16 inches, and the one side of the end of the beam is convex, and the just on the opposite side of that is the long edge is concave, and deeply reddened or oxidized. So Gordon Ross has done some analysis about this and suggests a concussive blast to break the weld points, because there were no stiffening plates overlapping and tying one column to the next. So I think that it's very conceivable that while some of the product could be damaged, the rest of it could be intact and ready to go.
Each charge.
Oh, but that raises the question of how they would have gotten access to the building at all to place these explosives.
Right.
We do have one possibility that's very, very plausible, and that would be if you had access to the core columns, the elevator shafts in the buildings, you would have access to the core beams and columns, and you could place these explosives without anybody knowing. So especially if you had the guys under the guise of an elevator modernization, which, in fact, we had going on the 9 months prior to 9/11. The largest elevator modernization in history was going on in these towers.
That is interesting.
And we had 85 employees of Ace Elevator who actually scattered as soon as the first plane hit the building. They were supposed to stay around and help the firefighters rescue the victims. This was quite a scandal, and it was documented in USA Today.
Right. So the elevator workers were actually on the site on the day as well.
Yes.
Right. Right. That's interesting. Yeah, look, I mean, I guess the charges could well have been all radio frequency triggered. So you don't need detonation cords. So that, I mean, that obviously that, you know, that concept that you have to run miles of wire, you know, it's just not particularly relevant. And of course we've got to get back to the hard science, I guess, of the fact that we know that the building had to have been demolished because of all this other evidence. So really that evidence, which is the visual evidence, which is the just all the evidence that we've actually had from the very beginning, from the video evidence, in itself really is quite conclusive, isn't it, Richard? I mean, it's all the rest of what we're doing is basically finding more and more forensic proof of it. But the original evidence is just there in the gravitational acceleration, which cannot be explained without the use of an extra input of energy. It's that simple, actually.
Yeah, well, it's not what you and I think. It's what the audience members think, and the architects and engineers, and 85 to 90% of them seem to agree with the evidence. So, yeah, I'd have to say that it is convincing based on that.
There's just one other question I've got, which has come up often, and I wanted to get your take on it. The claims that a giant fireball went down the elevator shafts and blew out the windows in the lobby, which on the face of it seems utterly preposterous. And I've read some very convoluted arguments that were proposed as to how that might occur. What's your take on the probability or even possibility of a giant fireball going down an elevator shaft all the way from like the 80th floor or whatever down to the ground floor and then selectively blowing out the ground floor windows?
Well, you're referring to eyewitness accounts of explosions at the basement level.
Yeah, basement and ground floor, indeed.
Prior to the building collapse.
Yeah.
I don't think it's important to speculate.
Right, fair enough.
Whether that was a fireball or whether that was an explosion by other means. It's not something that I'm willing to argue either way. I find it irrelevant compared to all of the evidence that is very clear for explosive demolition going off at the top of the building.
Yeah, and that's I guess all we really need to focus on. I think there's often a tendency to want to have more and more things to look at to make it more and more involved, when in fact the best way to make progress is to stick with what is irrefutable and just basically not engage with. I mean, I've seen some of the interviews that were done that you did with BBC, and I noticed that they tried to, you know, make you speculate, and it must have been difficult to say no to that. I think with a lot of these media pieces that are done, they're trying to, as we've seen with the BBC, as we saw with the National Geographic piece, so they just try to present this in the worst possible way. And this is a large part of what, you know, I'm doing Truth News Radio for, is to provide an alternative to this tendency the media has to just always spin everything and to project their version of reality in the most underhanded of ways. And what's your experience with working with the BBC? How did you, and I think, were you on the National Geographic program as well?
Yes, and we spent in both cases over an hour highlighting all of this evidence, which we have touched on tonight, and for both of those programs. And they showed, in the case of National Geographic, absolutely none of it.
Right.
They had 2 hours, and they could have shown all of it. In fact, they brought us in to show us what they were showing, what they were going to air. And they did, in fact, in that review show us to our satisfaction what we were going to air. But then it all got cut out, and these three ridiculous experiments from the New Mexico Tech Institute's EMRTC, the Testing Materials Lab, got put in there, and they interviewed people who were basically just calling us lunatics.
Right.
So it was a clear setup for it was a hit piece.
Yeah.
There was no intention of showing science, but trying to make us look like conspiracy theorists. So a similar situation occurred at the BBC.
Yeah.
And at least the BBC, you know, showed some of our response, which our interview, which was evidence, and they showed Building 7 going down, so at least everybody could see, you know, what it looks
yeah.
like, that it was, in fact, a controlled demolition.
Great. Yeah, well, you know, sooner or later, I think the public is going to, I think that the knowledge of this, I mean, what I find here in Australia, we're not, we have no media coverage of any of these topics, zero. I would say the only time this has entered the mainstream media was actually an article which I wrote, which was published on a ABC Australia opinion site. It's like an opinion blog site for connected to the ABC, which is ABC is the government television and radio broadcaster here. Very, very dominant, very powerful, very similar to the BBC. That is the only time that this that the story, the questions, the 9/11 truth movement has kind of surfaced. Now, next week, you're going to be in Sydney, and you're going to be at the ABC studios, and I'm going to be there. I'm really looking forward to meeting you. And we're going to be standing outside the ABC studios in the city, and it'll be a really interesting day, I think, for anyone listening, if you'd like to turn up, have a chance to meet Richard Gage. And Richard, are you how do you feel about this this upcoming event and conference? You feel positive?
Oh, I'm totally excited.
Great.
I have never been to Australia. It's not on our radar.
Yeah.
Up here in the U.S., I'm sorry to admit.
Understand.
And I'm looking forward to seeing all of the wonderful sights there and being with you guys out on the street, because that is where we can gain the attention of the people and kind of put it in their face
yeah.
that this is a real issue and there are people out there concerned enough to spend their time creating visibility so that the rest of Australia and the United States can wake up to the reality that there are significant issues about the official story about 9/11 enough to pull the rug out from underneath the whole story, which is, of course, the reason that you have troops in Iraq and Afghanistan that are dying today.
We do.
It's the reason that we also have that sad state of affairs and that we've lost so many of our freedoms here in the United States that we used to cherish through the Patriot Act, the Military Commissions Act, and the Violent Radicalization Act, which they're trying to run through the Senate.
Indeed.
Where we lose our rights. It's very, very disturbing. We're turning into a police state. I don't know if you have. If it's that sad in
We have
in
had
Australia.
A parallel development here. It's quite chilling, the parallel, because it matches everything that's happened in the U.S. We had a series of anti-terror legislations that went through over a period of years. And, you know, they continue to bring in new measures, even with our new government. We had a conservative government for 12 years, which everyone hated in the end. And, you know, they were pro, you know, Iraq war and, you know, the Labor Party, which was the opposition party, which is now in government, came in, people expecting change, just very similar to what happened in the US. And what we found is everything just continued, exactly business as usual. But with the rhetoric and the kind of marketing that everything's changed, like it's almost like a promotional package was given to us that everything is changing, and yet everything is the same. It's quite bizarre.
Wow.
Yeah. And with that, you know, we have increased police powers, and constantly there's little things that, you know, they want to do. They want to have more powers to do this, more powers to do that. And behind all that, we always find the spectre of 9/11 being used. If you go to the Australian Federal Police website and look at their section on terrorism, they feature 9/11 as one of the main reasons why they've changed the whole way everything's done. Even now, years and years later, they still refer to 9/11 as the kind of, you know, seminal event that changed everything. We've got our work cut out for us, and we're in the same boat as you guys, and we're heading in the same direction. So,
great.
Yeah, look, I know it's very late for you, and so we should probably conclude the interview. I'm so glad that you came tonight, and really looking forward to meeting you next week.
Most definitely. Thank you so much, Harewood.
Absolutely. Great. Well, on that note, we'll say good night from Truth News Radio Australia.